What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar. This week, I'm joined by Senior Writer Igor Bonifacic from Engadget. Hey, Igor, how's it going?
Hey, thanks so much for having me, and I'm doing great.
Doing great. Awesome. Happy to have you here, because we've got some PC hardware to dive into, and I know you've got like nerdy thoughts about all this stuff. Specifically, we're talking about the new smaller Surfaces that Microsoft announced this week that I'm in the midst of reviewing, the new Surface Pro. Also joining us this week is Ben Elman. Hello, Ben, podcast producer.
Hi. I don't know if I have very much to say about Surfaces, but I'm going to be having fun listening.
You probably have something to say. We're going to talk about Samsung like buying up even more of like hi-fi
yes.
audio. Like that's
I have some feelings about that.
Samsung buying Massimo. I don't think that's good for the audio industry in general. And stay tuned to the end of this episode, folks. I have an interview, a nice long one, actually, with Astra Teller, the current head of X, not the social network, X formerly Google X. He is the guy who's been like heading up that moonshot factory, as they like to call it. And I really wanted to talk to him about like what the heck is a moonshot now? Like, especially now as we're not as optimistic about technology as I think they were 15 years ago when Google X was founded. I think we had a good chat, and just be sure to stay tuned to that at the very end of the episode. As always, folks, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes and drop us an email at podcastengadget.com. We also have your questions. Hopefully we can make time for one today. And one of those turned into an Asking Gadget question on the site with words, real written words. So, you know, your questions can go far. We want to hear your feedback. So join us or just send us some notes, please. You can also join us Thursday mornings, typically around 11 a.m. Eastern, but this morning it's a little early. But we're join us on our YouTube channel for our live stream. I would say just tune into the live stream or check our YouTube channel in the morning because we'll have the thing scheduled. But typically it's 11 a.m. and we'll show off gadgets. We'll chat with the audience. We'll have a fun time. So join us for that. Let's get right into what Microsoft announced this week, Igor, which is kind of weird because I think I talked to Microsoft ahead of announcing the new 12-inch Surface Pro, which is a smaller Surface Pro than the one they announced last year. This is still a Copilot Plus AI PC, and a 13-inch Surface laptop, which is also smaller than the 13.8-inch Surface laptop they announced last year. These are sort of like more compact mobile-focused versions of these computers. But when Microsoft talked about it, they almost made it seem like these were replacing the older models. But as I dove into like writing about it and asking for clarification, no, these are sitting alongside them, sort of like how Apple has different sizes of computers in its lineup. But just first thoughts, Igor, does the idea of a 12-inch Surface Pro make sense to you? Or is it something you want?
Well, as someone who at one point used the 12-inch MacBook, which famously had a terrible processor, this does kind of interest me.
It is sort of that revisited, right? It is low power, tiny computer. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, like a bit of, I guess, inside baseball for the audience. Our employer supplies us with 16-inch MacBooks. And let me tell you, impossible to travel with those.
Yeah.
I'm 36 and I feel like my back is just like not what it used to be, right? And the forecast on that is only getting worse, right? Mm-hmm. So give me the 12-inch Mac, the Surface Book, excuse me, and I'm here for it. So
I hear a lot of people being really wistful because that's 12-inch MacBook Pro. That was not that long ago. It was like 2014, 2015. This was even before, like, so that came after like the old school 12-inch MacBook, which used to be a thing. I think there's an iBook. Right,
yeah,
around
so
that size, too.
I believe it was their first fanless design, if I recall correctly. But this was before, important to note, it was before the M1 era, right? The Apple Silicon era, right? And so I believe it was an Intel processor, right?
It was weird.
Hot garbage, this processor, like in no other way to put it, right? Like,
but did you like that computer because it was so small, even though it was so slow?
I mean, I remember taking it to like events and people would just kind of like gawk at me for being like that weirdo with like the 12-inch MacBook.
Yeah.
Right. But it was the only computer I had at the time. So anyway, but, you know, I do want to point out one interesting thing about this whole Microsoft thing is that also, as far as I understand, raising the prices of old Surface laptops by of them by 20%. Right. So how does that affect the value, I suppose, of these new ones?
It's it's weird. Like, the more I'm testing this thing, first of all, this is a cute Surface. This is the cutest Surface I've ever seen. It is super thin. It is 1.5 pounds, which is exactly the same weight as the iPad Pro 12.9 inch. And I feel like that's what Microsoft's getting at. But the overall value proposition, Igor, is a thing I've been thinking about. Because the day before these two devices were announced, and I believe they're, let me just double check here, but the Surface Pro, the new Surface Pro starts at $800. The new Surface laptop starts at $900. The day before these were announced, the 13-inch Surface laptop and Surface Pro, or the bigger Surface laptop and the 13-inch Surface Pro, were both on sale for the same price. So the 13-inch Surface Pro was $800 on Monday. Yeah. The laptop, I think, was down. Let me see here. Yeah, the laptop was also on sale for $800. The next day, those prices got jumped back up above the MSRP that they launched at last year. So now those things were sell. It's like, what is it now? It's like $1,200. There's a slight discount, so it's like over $1,000 for. They're more. They're more expensive, and they had to do this because they just announced these cheaper, more compact, or they announced these more compact, less powerful devices. So they had to scale up the old family, but they didn't improve those old computers. They didn't do anything to them. It's just, they just decided to reorient the pricing. So I'm a little pissed off about that. I'm going to bring that up in the review of just like how, oh, nothing means anything anymore. Like, pricing doesn't mean anything. Xbox prices are rising. You can blame tariffs for that. But this is entirely a situation of Microsoft's own making. And I'm a little baffled by this. So first of all, how do you feel about that pricing thing I laid out? Like, would you feel good buying a 13-inch Surface Pro now, knowing it's essentially going to be $200 to $300 more than it was at the beginning of the week for no reason? No reason at all.
And for additional context for our audience, I live in Canada where we don't have real money. So this is probably going to cost $500 extra. And I would, and also, may I ask, is it still the type covers not included? Microsoft is going to die on this hill of like not taking that hit and including the type cover.
No, they're never going to do this. Like, I think, when was the first Surface launch? The Surface Pro RT, I think, was the thing, but it was like 2011, 2012. That was like my first question to Microsoft. This thing looks really cool. Why is this keyboard not included? And every single year when Panos Panay was like doing events and stuff, I would like get up to him and was like, hey, what are we doing about this keyboard? Because nobody is going to buy these devices and just use it as a Windows tablet. You're going to buy these things because you want a weird hybrid tablet / laptop. You're going to need the type cover. Nobody else is making type covers. You can Bluetooth like a Logitech external keyboard or something to it, but there's nothing that fits into the slot that Microsoft has provided on these devices. So the keyboard is still another $150. So the total cost of buying a 12-inch Surface Pro, which is underpowered, slower than last year's models, is essentially $950 in the US plus tax.
When I used to work for a little known website called Mobile Syrup in Canada, you know, I would write our Surface reviews, and we had a famously engaged comment section, and every time, like clockwork, let me tell you, there was someone who would argue with me saying that Windows was a tablet OS. And it's like, let me tell you, my friend, it is not. No. It is the furthest thing from a tablet optimized OS, right? And so using the Surface Pro just as a tablet, it really makes no sense. You're like, it's like putting a crutch on this, what is, and I think still is, a really great computer, right? Like, but it really needs that type cover.
And you need the type cover. You're not going to buy an $800 tablet and then not have a thing to type into properly, because Windows has come a long way. Windows 11 has come a long way since like the early days of like Windows 8 and whatever the hell they were dealing with, on the early Surfaces. They went all in on like a Windows tablet interface, which was just slow and clunky and bad. Mm-hmm. Now it's still mostly desktop first, but it does rotate faster. Like, there's a smoothness. Like, if I'm reading an article and I just want to flip the keyboard back and turn it portrait and just read it longhand, like, it is smooth and I like that experience. But that is so much a secondary experience to how I use these things. Let me go into the good for the Surface Pro 12 inch. It is really light, like 1.5 pounds. It feels, you know, it feels like an iPad Pro. It's nowhere near as thin as the new iPad Pros, but I'm holding up to the camera here on stream, but it is thin. Like, this is the nicest feeling Surface I've felt yet, but they've never really had a problem with like building nice feeling hardware or really cohesive hardware. We reviewed the Surface Pro X several years ago, I think 5 years ago at this point, which was really nice hardware. And up until this point, that was the lightest full-size Surface. That was a 1.7-pound device. At 1.5 pounds, this one feels good. You add the keyboard on. The keyboard, I got to double-check the weight, but the keyboard doesn't bring it up to 2 pounds. So it's still like really compact, but it's still a big device too. So if I'm like reading, if I'm reading it as a tablet, if I have the keyboard on, it feels too hard on my wrist. It doesn't feel like light enough. It's not as like easy to hold as an iPad. So I want to take off the keyboard and just hold it like a tablet then. That works just fine. But this thing is a downgrade in so many other ways, because both this and the new 13-inch Surface laptop are powered by a Snapdragon X Plus chip, which is an 8-core chip. The ones that came out last year, it was either 10 or 12-core Snapdragon X Plus and X Elite chips. So it's a slower processor. In my testing, it is pretty much on par with like the Asus ZenBook A14, which I reviewed a couple months ago, which was like my favorite. The cool thing going to CS, super light, like 2.2-pound Windows laptop, it's super slow because it has this just really, really slow underpowered chip. You can use it just fine. Like, it does basic productivity work. This thing has 16 gigabytes of RAM. It's fine, but it just feels like we're taking a step back performance-wise just to hit this, like, you know, size target. So when I say that, Igor, are you compelled?
So I'm reminded, you know, how similar is this to the old Surface Go, right? Because I think that's probably the closest parallel to this device, right? And that device, I remember, again, too early for its time, right? Way ahead of its time, because the processor technology just wasn't there, right? And I guess the question I would also ask is, do you feel the Snapdragon X project has been a success, right? Because I feel like it was something that like Qualcomm, they like beat their chest about, but you know, in terms of performance, they're like, we're beating Apple, but I still feel like the Apple Silicon is just the way it's integrated with macOS. And I think just, you know, maybe Apple's willingness to say, to burn the past is, whereas Microsoft, you know, they have to maintain those legacy users. It has just allowed Apple Silicon to be more successful. And yeah.
I mean, certainly, I'm going to go step backwards through your question. So yeah, Apple Silicon, absolutely more successful. We talked about that last year because Apple owns the hardware and the software, right? So they can really fully control that stack and build the chips to exactly what they need and do things like integrated memory and make that available to the GPU and just have this really fast, tight system. Last year's devices, the Copilot Plus things we saw with Snapdragon X Elite, they were fast. Like the Surface Pro, Surface Laptop were really fast. Microsoft, I think more importantly than any of the like AI stuff that they had announced, they finally made Windows good for ARM chips. So like ARM mobile first chips, that was the Achilles heel for Windows for a long time. Since the very first Surface, the Surface RT, if you had an ARM chip, you couldn't run legacy software. You could only run some apps from the Microsoft store. It was a really locked down, slow experience. So as of last year, they have better emulation for x86 apps. So you can actually install older legacy Windows apps and be fine. A lot of games aren't supported. Some games just don't even launch on ARM at all. I believe Fortnite is one of those because of the cheat prevention stuff. And I've seen like some companies say they're going to work on like making their cheat prevention tech work better on Snapdragon chips in the future. So maybe that'll change. But no, you know, overall, Apple Silicon is better. That is why when I wrote the Asking Gadget piece last week, when somebody was asking, should they move from Windows to Mac? Absolutely. Like Mac is where it's at in terms of hardware, performance, efficiency, battery life, everything. But if you have to run Windows, like they're doing a better job than they have been with ARM chips. So there is that. I do remember the Surface Go. I reviewed pretty much all the Surface Go's, and I think Microsoft quietly just like killed that thing because now you could only buy it from the business website. It was a small 10-inch Surface, but it was really thick and it was super slow because the initial ones ran on like essentially Celeron chips. So they were super, super slow. But I think they wanted to like, what could they make for like a $500 to $600 budget Surface? they tried, you know, I think that got slowly better, but also you still had to buy the type cover separately. Like by the time you created the package of like a usable hybrid laptop, it was more expensive than a cheap Windows PC. And I don't think nobody really cared about that thing. This is sort of like the in-between between the Surface Go and like the bigger, more powerful Surfaces. I'm interested to see what people think of this. Like there's no more Surface connector port, that like nice little charging port that is magnetically attached. So if you like pull your computer, it doesn't come tumbling down. It's only USB-C. We dug deeper into like the specs. There is no SSD in this. It is a UFS, I believe it's called. It's the flash thing.
UFS 3.0. Like,
yeah, I'm not sure which exact model. Actually, that's a good point. But it is universal flash storage, yeah, which is something we see more on phones and like mobile devices. But it's not upgradable like the SSDs are on the bigger Surface Pro and the Surface Laptop. The screen is a lot worse, lower resolution, lower refresh rate. Yeah. So it's a smaller screen, but they went really low. Like, let me see here. The Surface Pro, like the new 13-inch Surface Laptop only has a 1080p screen.
Mm-hmm.
For a 13-inch laptop, that doesn't feel good to me. Maxes out at 90 hertz refresh rate, as does the Surface Pro. The bigger Surfaces can go up to 120 hertz. These are both also stuck with LCD screens. The bigger Surface Pro you can equip with an OLED if you pay up to like $1,500, I think. So, yeah, like I'm testing this thing. It feels good. It feels perfectly fine for like a basic productivity machine, but the minute you try to like do more, like if you want to maybe occasionally encode a video or cut something, just stress it a little bit, I think it kind of falls apart. It's just not very strong or powerful enough for that. It's also fanless like the new MacBook Air, but not as powerful or capable as the MacBook Air. I also want to do my test where I use it in like full direct sunlight and see like, can this computer survive 80 degrees in direct sunlight in Georgia heat, which it's still getting humid, even though it's like late spring at this point. So I'm in the midst of reviewing this thing. I think it's like it feels good, but it's also kind of confusing. And I think if you're interested in this family of stuff, maybe look closer at the 13 Surface Pro when it goes back on sale. But will that even happen? Like, will prices ever come back down because everyone's worried about tariffs? Everyone's worried about so many things. Any thoughts, Igor, as I've laid this out? Like, is this compelling or would you rather do the Surface Pro 13-inch?
I think I would just rather do the 13 Pro because I think, like, I do need to do some photo editing, you know? So any, like, it's just so frustrating when a computer is this slow in this day and age, right? Like, I mean, what I will say is, like, I think, you know, I think the Surface division has struggled in terms of, it has had an identity crisis, even like dating back to when Panos was there, right? And I think it's good that they're trying something new and different. I just feel it's too still stuck in that like kind of corporate mindset that has dominated Microsoft for so long. And I just wish I think they could really hit it out of the park with the Surface, but it's always a question of like, well, what does this mean for our partnerships with our OEM partners, right? You know, and like, we don't want to upset them kind of deal.
I don't know if that's necessarily it. Like, it's just, Microsoft has always been slow, right? They've been slow to the chip designs. For some reason, Surfaces have always had like older Intel chips for the longest time. I think the Snapdragon X stuff was the first time they were on par with brand new chip tech. And they also finally got Windows ready for ARM. Maybe there is a bit of that, but I just feel like it is too big of a company to really truly innovate. Like the first initial Surface pitch was really good. That made a lot of PC companies want to make a convertible computer. So like ones where you could just turn the screen around or flip the hinge all the way around. And I think Surfaces helped make that more of a thing, but I don't see people with actual Surfaces out in the wild. I still think like the usability wise, this thing is kind of annoying because the hinge is a problem. Like the hinge, it's cool. It was cool when they first announced it. It's still terrible to use in your lap. The only way they kind of tweaked it to make that good was the Surface Laptop Studio, which is the one that is their MacBook Pro equivalent, essentially. But that is the one where it opens up like a normal laptop, but you could pull the screen forward and it kind of hinges on like an A sort of like an A-frame type thing. And I think that was a good upgrade over it. You can't really do that on the Surface laptop, but maybe you could do something like what Apple has done with some of the iPad Pro cases, I think. There are other ways to do it. We've seen PC makers kind of explore this quite a bit. So I think the hinge remains an issue. The new keyboard feels fine. It actually has a decent amount of depth, but it is more cramped because physics. That's just the size it is. It also doesn't angle up slightly like the old ones used to, which was a nice ergonomic way to type on a Surface. Now it's always flat. It still feels good, but if you're used to even having that bit of comfort on Surface, that's gone. It is a weird device. I think for some people who've always wanted like a nice compact Surface, this is it. This is kind of the Surface you've been waiting for. I just wish it was as fast as like the 10 or 12 core. Like I wish it was a little zippier and a little more useful. So that's kind of where I'm at. I'm finishing up my review of that, and that should be up on the site this week. We don't have the new Surface laptop yet. I'm kind of expecting the same thing. It is the same chip. It's going to have the same performance issues. Battery life on the last year's Copilot Plus PCs were really good. Like that was 16 to 18 hours from my testing. So I'm expecting good stuff here. I need to do the full test. So it's just kind of a mixed bag. But if I were to score this, it's going to be somewhere in the mid-80s, mid to low 80s, probably. Some things I would recommend to some people with a lot of caveats, basically. So yeah, that is the new Surfaces. They are smaller. They're more compact. The bezels are still there. It's making still plenty of Microsoft mistakes, but there is that. So yeah, stay tuned for more thoughts on this and the Surface laptop if we get our hands on that soon too. And yeah, I'm sure I'll have more about to say about the Surface Pro eventually too. All right, moving on to other news. Keep up with us, folks. We saw the leak. Asus and Microsoft's Xbox-branded handheld seems to have been leaked in FCC photos. It looks like it has a 7-inch 120Hz LCD screen. Yay. An 8-core AMD Ryzen CPU. Good. It looks exactly what I expect because Asus knows how to build Windows gaming handhelds at this point. Igor, thoughts on this?
Oh, so many. One, we really need to see what... I really hope that there's announcement of a optimized version of Windows for handhelds, right? Because I think, as much as people like to say that the Steam Deck now has quote unquote outdated hardware, the software is just leaps and bounds better than I would not consider any of the Windows handhelds over the Steam Deck. One, because of the OLED, but two, because of just like, Valve is just such a step above in terms of software. And, to your earlier point of, the Surface and like integrating that integration between hardware and software, Microsoft doesn't have a great track record with that, right? And so I am still very curious to see it, right? And I hope it's a success because I think this is just like such a great, like it's been such a renaissance for PC gaming, right? Is these handhelds, and it really has opened it up to a much bigger audience. And I think, for all the like downfalls of PC gaming, we'll talk maybe a bit about your MOBO troubles, but like I honestly think like PC gaming is the best just because there's just so much creativity and such amazing games and like such a great spectrum of games. And the hardware part of it, if you're like nerds like us, it's so fun to like, build your own PC and like nerd out on this stuff. But these handhelds are like, this is just such a no-brainer for Microsoft. And it's really just shocking it took them this long to like, they could have gotten this done years ago, So
this is Microsoft, man. Like this is just how, I'm sure they've actually been thinking about this for years, but also there's a push and pull, right? They are a major console maker. Do they want to waste time in the like, niche market of gaming handhelds? Maybe this will actually be the main market for them moving forward. We talked about like when basically around the Switch 2, how much the original Switch shifted the landscape of gaming. I think the Switch proved that the Steam Deck was possible. So Valve cannot deny that, even though they were playing around with like all sorts of different gaming devices before. The actual handheld hardware has gotten better. To be clear, the leak shows two versions of the Asus ROG Ally 2 with Xbox buttons and a top-end one. The Xbox version of the ROG Ally 2 has that 8-core AMD chip. There's a regular model with an AMD 4-core chip and probably lower memory or something too. But this is fine. the hardware is not surprising. You're right. It's really the software that they're going to have to be dealing with here. People have pointed out that I've been playing more in the Xbox PC app because I'm playing a lot of Clair Obscur, and that game is just amazing. But there is a clock in the Xbox app right now. So really all you need to do is, when you open a Windows gaming handheld, is just launch the Xbox interface and that's it. I do hope they have a streamlined version of Windows coming. We've talked about like spitballing what Microsoft could do. Just the real baller thing, especially as Xbox prices have gotten higher and whatnot, is just like, you know, those cute little, those powerful little boxes that are under some of your TVs. That is a full ass Windows desktop now. You know, let's go, baby. Like, just let people install Steam. Let people treat it like a computer. I actually think that would be compelling for a lot of people, because a self-contained gaming PC like that would be good and would lead to more Xbox Game Pass purchases and people actually buying and playing games. Mm-hmm. That, to me, would be an ultimate win for Microsoft. I don't see them making another, like, high-powered gaming console again, because this is, like, you could do it in a handheld. You could do it in a handheld that goes in a dock. You can bring PC hardware down. Maybe a future Xbox is just essentially a desktop PC, because that's what the Series X feels like. So there's a lot of ways it could go with that. We shall see. We shall see. We're staying tuned to all of this. Also, let me see here. We did want to talk about OpenAI's thing that you wrote, Igor, like their new for-profit plan. I believe their plan not to go public anymore, which to me feels like that's a sign your business is actually not that stable and probably shouldn't be a public company. But do you have any thoughts about that, about how they're proceeding or trying to make money at this point?
Yeah. So just to be clear, we don't know whether they plan to go public. I assume at some point that is the end game. The question now is, you know, previously they were, what they wanted to do was kind of separate control of the for-profit, which is the company that makes, you know, the software that you're familiar with when you're using ChatGPT, right? Compared to the nonprofit that controls that entity. And it's more complicated than that. I'm like really oversimplifying it, because if you look at OpenAI's org chart, it is just like a monster of a org chart with, and it's not even as detailed as I think filings have shown. But as with all things with OpenAI, they really didn't say enough about the plan, right? And so I talked to some legal scholars, and they're like, it really depends on like how they structure this company moving forward, right? Like, how much of a voting share will the nonprofit have? And will it, you know, will that voting share be in perpetuity, or is it something that could be diluted through an IPO? And so I think if you're a critic of the company, and I would encourage everyone to be, because it's like one of the most important companies working in the space right now, is, you know, will the nonprofit eventually control this thing, you know? And so it's really in the weeds, but it was really enjoyable to write about and just learn about more, because again, this is such a transformational company, for better or worse. And it really needs to be held to account.
I don't want to get any more in the weeds here, Igor, but I feel like I have to for a second. A lot of this confusing stuff that you're talking about with the org chart and whether it's a nonprofit or a for-profit is all linked to the very brief Sam Altman ouster too, correct?
Yes. Yes. It really, I think the originally the plan as it was announced in December was to turn it just into a for-profit, right? With the, and the nonprofit controller would just get some amount of like return on investment and like, or I shouldn't say return on investment, but like some kind of stake in the company, but it would not have control, right? And I think this is really just Sam now trying to ensure that he, or in December, it was just really Sam trying to ensure that he maintained control of the company. And specifically the structure they're going for, which is called a public benefit corp, one of the things that it would protect OpenAI from is a hostile takeover, specifically from one Elon Musk, right? Or at least it hasn't been tested in court yet, but the belief is that it would protect them from these kind of things, right? And as we've seen, like, Elon really wants to take control of OpenAI, right? And so this is an extension, as you said, of that ouster and ensuring that he still has control and that his allies still have control.
It all feels like this company is just so unstable. Like, I think the actual, as much as like people are excited about their generative AI, like the basic functioning of them as a company is also kind of broken. Like, I think I subscribed a while back to test out, you know, some GPT model. They're still billing me, even though I canceled, like I unsubscribed. Yeah. I'm still getting like a $20 charge. I'm like, you just have not figured, I got to fix that. But also you have not figured out basic billing and customer service and customer like experience stuff. Yeah,
for sure. And that is something that I've heard about the company, is that the like the people who are working on the product feel very separated from the people kind of doing like more broader research and kind of policy stuff. And it's still very much, you know, because I think when Sam and others founded OpenAI, like they didn't, I mean, I don't know like how much you want to believe them, but you know, they're right, like, oh, right. We were just like, you know, figuring out what AGI meant. And like, you know, there was no expectation this would become a profitable venture at some point. Right. And so to your point, I think there is still a lot that they need to figure out. And I think they're constantly in the process of figuring it out.
It is wild that Elon Musk and all Sam Altman and everybody was like, we're gonna build the company to stop the bad AI, to stop the bad AGI. Yeah. And I don't know. I don't even know what's happening anymore. So yeah, I'm sure we'll have more to say about that. Among other stupid news this week, the Trump administration announced plans to shut down the Energy Star program because saving power is bad for America. Saving energy is bad, apparently. We don't know what's happening here. But this announcement, let me see, it occurred during an all-hands meeting at the EPA's Office of Atmospheric Protection. This originally started in 92. If you've bought a home appliance at any point, especially things like refrigerators or washers or whatever, big appliances, TVs, you have the STAR, you have like an estimate of how much this device will cost you to use over time. I think that's all like good stuff for consumers to have access to. But no, apparently... That is just like any regulation bad for the Trump administration.
The bizarre thing about this, though, is I was grumbling about this to my roommate. My roommate is a green energy analyst. Mm-hmm. So he uses the Energy Star like website all the time. The company that he works for actually does a lot of consulting for Energy Star. So you can say that he's in the tank for Energy Star, but like he's in the tank for you saving you money. Okay, sure. He said, so I was grumbling about it. I was like, oh, well, you know, this is just to, you know, benefit the owners of utility companies. And he's like, what are you talking about? The utility companies also want you to use less electricity.
This is for the device
makers.
Because
it's better for them, too.
Because they can barely keep up with, like, demands at this point. So they're like, for the love of God, turn off your shit. Like, please use less electricity during peak times. This is for the device makers, and I'm sure a lot of American manufacturers who are just like, to hell with efficiency. You want a fast dryer? We'll give you the fastest, hottest dryer. How much energy is that going to burn? Don't worry about it. Not our problem. Some stats here. In the past 33 years, data says Energy Star has helped save more than $500 billion in energy costs. It helps an average American save $450 per year on energy bills. By showing those standards. So, you know, just a good public benefit, which is the sort of thing we were just seeing less of from this administration. Be careful out there, folks. Do your research when you're going to buy appliances. And remember our golden rule, never buy a Samsung appliance. Never buy a Samsung appliance.
I agree.
I keep seeing TikToks about this too. Like, it's like people working at the stores, they're looking at the Samsung. No. They're looking at like a Samsung washer or a Samsung dryer. No, that's a recipe for disaster. Samsung refrigerator. I'm sorry. We like their phones.
They look so pretty, though.
They look so pretty. Listen, I'm a sucker. I bought that LG fridge with the window, and you knock on the window and you see what's inside, which is great for my kids' snacks, but also it's LG. LG is like rock solid. Everybody loves LG appliances. But this is also the sort of thing where you can look at an LG versus a Samsung appliance and also see like energy rating differences too. This doesn't tell you quality differences. Wouldn't it be nice if you could walk into a store and actually see review stuff? You know, this has been rated well by Engadget or wherever. That's actual consumer protection. That would be super helpful. Anyway, I hope this doesn't, like, I hope this is not an extended thing. I know somebody who works for the EPA in my neighborhood. I need to talk to them about their thoughts on this. But yeah, also, I don't know if we fully talked about this, but it was discovered that the Trump administration is now using a Signal clone for messaging, telemessage, it's essentially a modified version of Signal, which is unauthorized from Signal, that company said. Turns out that clone was hacked. Telemessage was hacked. And after discovery of this, telemessage, I believe, has ceased. It's no longer working, I believe, right? They turned off their service. But also that information, whatever, like, clearly secret and confidential government information that was there, is open to whoever hacked it. So, fun times. Fun times in America.
It comes back to the idea that Jamel Bowie, the New York Times columnist, talked about a few weeks ago, which is that any competent intelligence service should have just like a live feed of what's going on in the White House.
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. Live feed, live updates. I'm sure some people are getting like live real-time health data on people in the White House because like...
Any intelligence service around the world that's worth its salt probably has some way of peering into some of the secret conversations that are happening. And that's great.
That's great.
It makes
America
very safe.
I don't know if you saw this, Dev, but Tulsi Gabbard was also found to have been using the same password on all her accounts. And it was...
I saw that.
And it was the password. I forget the exact phrase, but it's related to some cult that she said she has never had any part of.
Oh, no.
Our director of national intelligence has long been tied to like what's essentially a Hindu cult, I believe. I think it is. But it's a cult of some kind. Hey!
Yes.
Great. So. Great on every level. You know what? This is depressing. Let's talk about, I don't know, what do you call this? Monopolies. Instead, let's talk about Samsung is paying $350 million to buy Massimo, which may not sound that interesting, except Massimo is the owner of brands such as Bowers & Wilkins, Denon, Marantz, and Polk, like really, especially Bowers, like high-end audio speaker stuff. Samsung already owns Harman Kardon and JBL. It's actually the Harman brand that bought the Massimo stuff. So essentially, so much of like the great hi-fi speakers and technologies and receiver stuff that people have been into in like the hi-fi subculture for a while, it is now owned by Samsung. What did we just say about Samsung? This is not good. This is not like...
Okay, but yeah. Like, is audio an appliance?
I mean, I think a speaker is like one of the best appliances because a good speaker will last you freaking decades. We've talked about...
Okay, but yeah. I don't really think about a speaker in the same vein as like... washing machine.
You're right. Right. It is a completely separate division. But also, to me, it's just a sign of like, oh, this is the company with the exploding Galaxy Note. This is the company that released the $2,000 folding phone that didn't really work, but still made people pay $2,000 for it, and it fell apart all the time. I don't trust Samsung in general.
I think broadly, like, you know, consolidation of any market is bad, right? Like, Samsung already owns AKG, right? Like, there, as you said, there's so many brands that it owns, and it just has less and less incentive to actually compete on price, quality, technology, and that's just a loss for everyone.
It absolutely is. I think the main thing, and Samsung, I have to look at the numbers, like Samsung at this point must be a bigger company than Sony, because Sony has actually fallen far from like where it used to be. It kind of just has PlayStation holding it together. But it clearly seems like the people at Samsung are just like, we could kind of crush Sony. Just show, we're going to own all the audio gear. We're going to make Blu-ray players. We're going to do the appliances. Sony doesn't make appliances. We're going to make the TVs and the panels that go in those TVs.
Sony makes chips. Great sensors. So at least they have that as well.
When I wrote a story about like, will Sony ever be like king of the consumer products hill again? One of the main Sony like PR reps called me. It was just like, what the hell, man? We have sensors. I'm like, yeah, dude. We have the leading camera sensors. Yeah, I know you do. That's great. Good for you. Where are those sensors? Not always in Sony cameras and also in other products. Like, you're not where you were, you know, 20, 30 years ago, clearly.
I mean, just there's this great Blue Sky account called Obsolete Sony where it just some dude who really loves old Sony stuff just like post pictures, and it's like whenever he posts like some like 50-pound CRT, I'm just like, like shoot it straight into my veins. Like this was like the golden age of technology in my humble opinion.
Give me like the things you would only see in anime shows, like a widescreen Trinitron CRT in the 90s was like my dream for so long. Like never had a chance. I think I actually got a monitor that was Trinitron technically. It was a Samsung monitor, but he was using Trinitron technology. There's something else here. What's good about Sony? I miss minidisc, like how broken and messed up that was as a format. But I remember just like the things you used to do with minidiscs didn't skip. There's that Sony CD player where like it's a glass opening for the CD. And you put the CD and you see the CD spin as you listen to music. To me, that was always like the height of like, oh, if I can get there in the 90s, I'd made it. I've made it in life. I saw somebody buy that for like $20 at a Goodwill and they TikToked about it like, this was my dream. This is how far Sony has fallen. Anyway, so Samsung has bought Massimo. We don't know what's going to happen to these brands. RIP to anybody who, I don't know, if you love this stuff and their specific tech, I hope it doesn't get worse. There are other brands out there. I bought an Integra receiver recently. I had actually bought a Sony one first. This Integra one went on sale and had better tech in it, so I just returned the Sony because Sony was not up to snuff, actually. Finally, there's a report that Half-Life 3 is reportedly playable in its entirety, could be announced this year. Igor, how excited are you about this potential news? Are you taking it seriously at this point?
Why do we believe this also?
Because it's from a good source, Ben. It's from a good source.
Okay, tell me why this is a good source.
Tyler McVicker, who's known for reporting on Valve rumors, the guy who's like looking at all the like little, all the data, all the behind the scenes stuff at Valve and like is leaking a lot of stuff. This guy is saying it's true. I have a little bit of hope. Igor, what do you think?
I mean, if it's true, I'm really excited, right? And I think so. If you haven't watched the 20th anniversary documentary on Half-Life 2, it gives a bit of good context about this. And it really, what it, like Gaben said, was just like, we could have easily finished episode 3, but it would have just been finishing the story. And every Valve game needs to push the technological and like gameplay aspect of it. Mm-hmm. And I think they really feel like, I think Valve's been cooking, right? Like, and I think based on this and the fact specifically the code references to HLX, right? I think that's a really good sign. And I wonder if like, I hope it's not a VR game because I still haven't played Half-Life Alyx because I refuse to buy a Meta device.
Wait, you don't need a Meta device. You can play that on any headset.
But they make the best ones price per like.
Let's talk, Igor. You want to play Half-Life Alyx?
Okay, we'll talk. We'll figure out how I can play Half-Life Alyx before all of this. But yeah, I mean, I would really love this to be true. And I'm like really curious to like, I hope, you know, because I think really a big problem in PC game or gaming in general now is just the dominance of Epic and the Unreal Engine. And I think if like Valve can push the Source engine or whatever engine they're working with for HL3, like I think this is going to be like probably the like the game of the generation easily, right? Because it's and in a generation where not much has happened, right? So. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Other things, Ben. A concept artist for Valve said they were in the room where they made Half-Life 3. Valve, another Valve leaker, said that Half-Life 3 would be the end of Gordon's adventure. This seems like... So there were also reports from the person who essentially wrote Half-Life 3 or wrote what would be a version of Half-Life 3 put all his info out like a couple of years ago too. And we talked about that. I think we even wrote some stories like, oh yeah, we'll just never see Half-Life 3 at this point. I don't even know if like, are people even like excited about that beyond the like hardcore gaming franchise? Like are kids, since Half-Life 2 was released, you've got full people who were babies and now full blown adults. You know, I don't know.
Yeah. So I've spent the majority of my life looking forward to Half-Life 3. I'm not much younger than Igor. And I remember playing Half-Life 2 in middle school. I was a child then.
I played Half-Life.
We were speculating about Half-Life 3 from what, 2005, 2006 onward?
I played Half-Life 2 right after I graduated. Like, I think, right after graduating from college. And
oh,
a whole lifetime ago. basically. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the big reasons the Orange Box existed on the Xbox 360 was to bundle together Half-Life 2 and Episodes 1 and 2 along with Team Fortress, right?
But so that was also the beginning of Steam. And Steam was this epic moneymaker, not Epic the company. It was this epic moneymaker for Valve where they're just like, we don't have to do anything. We just have to sit back here and print money. And Gabe Newell can be this weirdo billionaire. Doesn't he own like something
too
off
many
the,
yachts.
Off
New too many yachts.
Too many yeah. yachts, but I think he owns an island off of New Zealand too. Yeah.
As long as he's focused on yachts and not like political power or anything, go on, Gabe. Like, own as many yachts
wasn't
as
the
you
thing,
want.
It was some, maybe it was actual the index stuff, but there were stories that Gabe was just like wandering around Seattle delivering devices for like people ordered from Valve, and I think it was indexes, right?
Getting a Valve index delivered by Gabe.
There's a man in white with a long white beard at our door. He says he's Gabe Newell. I think he's crazy, man. I don't know. It is also wild that we're talking about this, and we didn't talk about this last week, but Grand Theft Auto 6 has been delayed until next year, next May.
True.
Who could have seen that one coming?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, and so in the chat, we've got user DPro9 saying, we got Half-Life 3 before GTA 6, which if you've been on any comments section in the last year, people are like, oh my God, I can't believe we have like a goat balancing on an exercise ball before GTA 6. Like, it's ubiquitous.
It's crazy. But hey, they released a new trailer, and you know what? That thing looks incredible. Like, I don't, it's going to be another GTA type of game, but it looks amazing. The sheer amount of detail.
It looks like a movie.
It looks like a movie. It looks like real life. You've got Steven Root is the first voice I heard too. It was like, he got some of my favorite voice actors and actors involved. They have like looked like they have once again created a whole world back in, was it Liberty City? Or no, that's Vice City, right?
It's Vice City. This, yeah.
It's Vice City.
Or the state, I suppose. Yeah.
It's just like, wow, we are really, as much as like gaming is in trouble right now, like just to see that and to look forward to that and see what games look like. I'm playing Clear Obscura now. That game looks incredible. I don't, there's a whole story about that too, about how that's like kind of a small team building that too. People who came out of Ubisoft, right? We need to have a full conversation about that game, maybe with Jess at some point, because holy crap. But anyway. Just talk about things.
So here's the other side of things before we move on to like stuff around Engadget. Right now we have kids who were born the year Half-Life 2 came out playing the Oblivion remaster on like and streaming it on Twitch.
So
if you're asking whether or not people care about video game history, they absolutely do. And I think it's just it will take Valve re-releasing probably Half-Life 2, like a big remaster or something for people to get back into it. And then just go back into
The anniversary update, honestly, that game, it still looks incredible. Like some of the shaders and stuff that they were using were just, and like the art design, and there's like really great workshop support where if you feel like an asset is like low resolution, there's someone who made like a beautifully crafted high resolution asset. And the game, like, I just played it recently on an OLED monitor, and it was like chef's kiss.
I need to do that. And didn't they add RTX stuff, or is that an add-on coming or something?
That's a free mod. Yeah, you can. Yes. I mean, I think
that's all I need. RTX, yeah, or ray tracing. I do want to point out, because Igor, it hurts me to hear that you're a Half-Life fan who have not played Half-Life Alyx, and I got to keep saying this. I reviewed Half-Life Alyx for us when that began, essentially when that came out at the beginning of the pandemic. Really weird to play that game, a really immersive game about the impact of a pandemic, but also alien invasion. That game is incredible. So do whatever it takes to play. If you care about Half-Life, if you care about the lore of Half-Life, if you are waiting for conclusions to things that happened at the end of Half-Life 2, you need to play Half-Life Alyx. Don't just sit here and wait for a Half-Life 3, because they're probably actually going to continue some of that story. Because there is like universe changing stuff in Half-Life Alyx. If you have a gaming PC, there are many ways to play VR right now. You don't have to get the Meta headset. You can find a used VR headset in some fashion at this point. So Igor, you can make it happen.
Let's
Ben,
talk
I hope
after
you can,
the show. Yeah, we'll
you
figure
can do
something
it. You can
out
do it somehow. Let's move on. Let's save the question for another week because I've got 5 minutes left. Okay, we'll save it for next week.
Yeah.
But thank you from Wes from Dallas-Fort Worth, who sent in a Switch 2 question. I'll get to it next week, okay?
We promise, Wes. I know you've sent in so many good questions.
I know. Wes,
I am going to make it a point to make sure that we cover your question next week.
I will also say, make sure your questions are things we can probably answer, because I don't. There are sometimes our questions that come in is like stuff. What is Nintendo thinking about this? We're just guessing. We don't know. We don't know what their plans are, but we shall see. Quick hit from around in Gadget. Amy Skorheim has reviewed the new Roku Streaming Stick Plus. She says it is perfect for travel. Gave an 85 score. They've been basically slowly tweaking all of their devices. Like, Roku is a weird company where it's really hard to tell what's different from year to year. But this is a good one. I think I bought one for my dad recently, too, because he needed, like, streaming apps and a basement TV. And this is it. Super cheap device that does the thing and you can travel with it. I love traveling with like an Apple TV or a Roku stick because you just have all your stuff set up. You just got to get it on Wi-Fi and you don't have to like worry about fighting with airport networks or whatever. Anything we're working on that you want to shout out, Igor?
I'm working on a review on a new Sigma camera that the BF, that it's like that unibody one. So, so if you've ever wanted to know what a camera would look like if like maybe Apple designed it, this is the camera for you.
Which how much
is
does to say that cost,
it is
Igor?
Beautiful but not very practical.
Is that like 2000 plus? How much is
it? Yeah, 2000 US. So yeah. I don't even want to know how much it costs in imaginary money. So yeah,
your Canadian dollars. Yep, I hear you. I'm in the midst of like reviewing something like the Surface Pro and maybe other things. I have a monitor review coming up. Also, shout out to you, Igor, for doing the 27-inch Alienware. That's a good review. That's the 240 hertz, right?
Yeah, 4K.
That's their newer OLED. 240 hertz OLED, 27 inches. I have to say, reviewing all these monitors has spoiled me. I cannot live with a monitor below 32 inches, sorry.
Yeah.
But I'm also still testing that 27-inch LG, so I'll have thoughts on that soon. Any pop culture picks you want to shout out real quick?
You know, I haven't been playing many video games or watching much, but I
Claire
did start
obscure. Claire obscure.
I need to. Yes. You but I did to. Recently start this. I discovered Julian Lage, who's this jazz guitarist. And if you haven't heard his music, it's really beautiful. So that's my pop culture.
How do you spell that?
L-A-G-E.
L-A-G-E. Okay. Thank you so much, Igor. I want to shout out something surprising. I had to review Thunderbolts for my movie podcast, and it's good. Not, in fact, just good. It's great. I think it's one of the best Marvel movies ever made, and honestly, a really refreshing start to the summer movie season. I don't expect this is going to be like, it's not going to be indicative of all the good stuff. Last year, we had freaking Furiosa, and we had Fall Guy. We had great action movies that nobody went to see. So I'm still like reeling and mad at audiences about that. Furiosa is freaking fantastic. But anyway, Thunderbolts is good. It's in theaters now. Go see Sinners if you haven't seen it yet, too. A lot of good stuff coming.
I need to see Sinners before it gets out of theaters.
I think you missed the... It will come back to IMAX at some point, but...
Yeah, IMAX I know. I probably missed the IMAX, but I'll see it on some other...
They will also re-release on IMAX at some point, too. But yeah, go see Sinners. Go see Thunderbolts, folks. Enjoy the movies. Go to the movies. And I think we can wrap this week. Why don't you go ahead and do that, Ben?
Thanks, everybody, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by me, Ben Elman. You can find Igor online at...
Igor Bonifacic at Blue Sky.
And you can find Devendra online at...
I'm at Devendra on Blue Sky and all over the internet. And you can find me talking about movies and TV at the Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
Don't at me on Blue Sky at Hey Bellman. Get that? Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. That includes Spotify.
And be sure to stay tuned to the end of this episode. Stay tuned just a few minutes, actually. I'll be chatting with Astra Teller, the current head of Google X, or now just X. We had a good chat, I think, about like how Google X is still trying to pursue moonshots, his philosophy about failure. Failure is a big one, too. He has a whole TEDx talk about why it's actually important to focus on failure if you're trying to do innovative products. So yeah, take a listen to my chat with Astra Teller. Astro Teller, thank you so much for joining us in the Engadget podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Happy to chat with you. And I've spent a lot of time just listening to your TED Talks and catching up on the Moonshot podcast that you guys are doing now. Can you tell us a bit about why now? Why is now the chance for or the time for X to kind of give us an inside look as to what's going on with a podcast?
Well, first of all, we're 15 years old. So yeah. That seemed...
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you. It seemed like a nice reason to sort of take a pause, create a bit of an oral history of what mm-hmm. we've done, give a chance for people outside who haven't seen as much of the people and the projects that have gone through X to find out about some of the great stories that have happened, and for us to be real about some of the things that haven't worked, because that's kind of our thing, is you don't get to great except by going through complicated. And you know, I'm a big believer that that's the reality. That's the physics of innovation. And anyone who says differently is just in denial. And so sharing the reality of how it works with people, I think, is important, because I'd love to see more people making their own moonshots in their own moonshot factories. Also, to some extent, you know, when X was younger, our track record wasn't quite as clear as it is now. And now that we have Google Brain and Waymo, Wing, the drones for package delivery, Intrinsic, our moonshot for industrial robotics, and many more like that that are out in the world and thriving, it's easier for us now to go back and say, like, how did we get here, and have people be excited about it because they can see the end result.
Gotcha. Looking at, you know, what X is doing today, and by the way, Google X is X. I'm wondering, how do you guys kind of differentiate it from the social network X? That seems kind of confusing now.
It's a very normal question, so I get the question all the time, but I almost never have somebody actually confuse us for X. We're the Moonshot Factory. Uh-huh. So if somebody looks up our podcast and you just type in the Moonshot Factory, Moonshot Podcast, like, we're what you'll find. But we've been X. I mean, as you just referenced, we were Google X before we were X. And then when Alphabet became Alphabet, this holding company, where Google was the main thing inside that holding company, but X and its progeny have been filling up these other things like Waymo inside of Alphabet, it made sense now that we were no longer a part of Google, but like a little sister to Google, to take the Google off our name and just call ourselves X. So that's how we came to be X. And we haven't had much problem with the confusion, because most people would call us the Moonshot Factory.
If I were you guys, I'd just be a little annoyed that that this X is now dominating the headlines. What is the role of X today in your perspective? You're 15 years on, and I think the initial pitch, as we heard it, I think as you guys kind of came out of a bit of secrecy, was that you wanted to be sort of like a Xerox PARC-like area to just like research things and test things out. Has anything really changed for you? You've seen some successes, I think more failures than successes, but you were going to talk about that too, why that's important. But has the actual role of X changed for you in these 15 years?
I mean, fundamentally, taking moonshots, doing things that are particularly audacious, that we can all agree ahead of time would be particularly good for the world if they worked, helping them get from that's a crazy idea that's probably wrong, all the way through to an enduring business, that's a very long, complex process, as you just referenced. Not just some things, most things die along the way. And what determines whether you're efficient or not at that process is how early you can get things to die for good, clear reasons, rather than sort of letting them linger and then they die later when you could have actually ended them much earlier. All of that, you know, are the three circles, which you've probably seen. We define a moonshot as huge problem with the world, science fiction sounding product or service that would resolve that huge problem with the world, and some kind of breakthrough technology that makes it at least possible for us to make that science fiction sounding product or service. None of that has changed in our 15 years. What has changed is that we've been slowly turning up the rigor dials on how to do this thing without killing the magic, to get more and more efficient and systematized about how we're doing it. So that's been a gradual, continual evolution for us. And then the other thing that's changed is we continue to learn about, okay, we have this thing, is clearly super valuable. What do we do with it? For a while, we weren't sure. So some things like Google Brain, which came from X, went back to Google because at the time we didn't have another place to put it. Then there was a period during which we were making other bets. So things like Waymo, Wing, the drones for package delivery, Intrinsic, and others, Chronicle, our cybersecurity moonshot, that came from X and then landed as these legally, culturally, and operationally separate entities within the Alphabet superstructure. That has been our job for a long time. And what we've realized is that for a lot of the things that we make, landing them just outside of Alphabet, where we own a large but minority position in them, and where once they're outside of Alphabet's membrane, they can go off on their own journey independent of some of the complexities that come with being a very large business like Alphabet, and they can then use market-based capital. So we're realizing and sort of evolving and tweaking kind of our off-ramp to help things that make sense outside of Alphabet rather than inside of Alphabet so that they can thrive, land successfully on that outside and then thrive, having landed in this place where we can be really proud of having made them. We still get a lot of economic upside if they're successful, but they also are sort of like, fly the nest, little bird.
I guess I'm sort of asking because, I started doing tech reporting professionally in like 2010. That was the height of like this dot-com boom, right? The post-recession dot-com boom, but also social networks were thriving. And there was a lot of tech optimism. I got that sense from you listening to you talk about X and what you guys have worked on. But also right now, it feels like we're also reckoning with a lot of stuff that happened over the last 15 years too, like the way social networks have kind of transformed the way truth works, the way technology has kind of infiltrated our lives. Has your idea of a moonshot changed at all, you know, in the past 15 years, or at least the things you want to target differently? Are they different now compared to the beginning?
I mean, for sure. Like, we've had waves of the things that we're looking at, transportation, robotics, climate change and sustainability. But just taking a step back, the history of humanity is a history of technology. Fire, the wheel,
written
roads,
word,
plumbing, aqueducts, you know, domesticating animals. Like, it's all basically technology. Almost all of human advances, including a lot of like the health advances, are technology. So, spoiler alert, if there are irresponsible people, no technology put into the hands of irresponsible people is going to go well. And if you have responsible people, then you can be pretty optimistic that technology is going to help the future. So I don't think that our job is to change and sort of like wiggle back and forth in our positivity about technology. Technology is the longest lever that humanity has for moving itself forward. Given that, let's show up as good human beings, as a good organization that is serious about only fishing at the intersection of purpose and profit. We're going to be wrong, but we can even be responsible about how we're wrong. So finding ways, like when Waymo's out, and like it's been for 15 plus years on the road, we've been paying trained drivers in, you know, shifts to sit with their hands right by the wheel so we could discover where the cars are confused without in any way endangering anybody else. Like, that's an example of us getting out, being wrong, learning and improving and doing it responsibly.
The Waymo's an interesting example because, yeah, I've been covering it, yeah, since basically you guys launched it. And we've seen it kind of grow. We've also seen like regulatory hurdles that Waymo has faced too. And I also feel like they're in the time that we've been talking about self-driving, it's gone from this really cool thing. And that felt like a thing that was coming for 10 years and all the big car manufacturers kind of took a step back because it was a big problem to solve. And now there's more of a, I don't know, I think a backlash to it as well. How are you guys kind of managing that? Because Waymo has accomplished some things, but there are also legitimate criticisms in terms of how Google has rolled out Waymo, how, you know, how these technologies intersect with normal people driving and how they work within, you know, just following traffic laws. It's gotten more complicated, I guess. Like, have you guys rethought things in terms of Waymo, or I guess in terms of the issues you saw with Waymo, have you predicted that and moving towards other things you guys are building?
Look, first, I don't speak for Waymo, just to be clear. They're a graduate of ours, but I don't speak for them. Second, just to use an example, one of the complexities that Waymo has to deal with is not that they don't follow the rules. It's actually that humans don't follow the rules, and it's freaking weird to have cars on the road that are actually reliably following the rules. What would you do if you were Waymo and you were confusing other people on the road because you were following the laws? Like, you can't not follow the laws fit in with everybody else. But it is also true that that could be confusing to humans because they're expecting that car ahead of them to not follow the rules, because that's what most humans do.
Sort of like reapply things like a human driver would such situation that is weird. Yeah.
Right. But Waymo's not going to go over the speed limit or 50 other things like that. So I've seen Waymo on the inside. Those are really good people. They're working exceptionally hard. I think they're making great choices. And we're going to look back on this time and think that humans driving cars was not that different than humans operating elevators. It's going to be at best quaint. Now, we can argue about some societal complexities in getting from here to there.
That's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah. I don't minimize those things, but those are social issues that we need public policy responses to. It is not, you wouldn't want it to be Waymo's job to decide how society is going to evolve. We need to respect the realities of, like, let's say, when we merge into traffic, if there are other humans driving the other cars, we need to make sure that the body language of our car signals to humans in a way that humans are used to, hey, I'm going now. That's a reasonable thing to ask our cars to do. We should be, serious and compassionate about the fact that there may are some jobs that are going to go away and some jobs that are going to come into being as cars start to drive themselves en masse around the world. But I don't think you want Waymo deciding how society is going to function in that new place. And I think Waymo doesn't even want that either.
For sure. I think it's more like the discussion about things like this, like how it changes societies. It seems like a good thing to open up. But Waymo's a good example of something that has graduated and has kind of taken off and is working pretty well for you guys. Your big thing, though, I've listened to your TED Talk and you bring this up quite a bit, is the idea of basically championing failure and trying to fail quickly so you learn quickly. Can you talk a bit more about that and how that's influenced the way you guys have built up Moonshot Projects?
Sure. Let me take a step back so that it becomes really clear to your listeners why I'm kind of the crown prince of failure, because I hate failing. I have no interest in failing. I am as serious as anyone you have ever met at succeeding. However, if you ask anyone, especially in the tech world, but it's probably true outside the tech world, think of the last really hard thing you did. But you lose all the code, all the hardware, everything you've written, if it was an article, whatever. But you get to keep in your head, and your team gets to keep in their heads, what the right answer was once you finished. How long would it take for you to rebuild the right answer? And depending on who you ask, if it was a thing where you knew you could do it, and it, like, most of it was hard work, like a house, it's like half, it'd take half the time once you've figured out all the complexities. If it's a normal tech thing, people say usually about 5 to 20% of the time that it would take to rebuild something. The weirder it is, the closer to 5% it is. The more normal it is, the closer to 20%. So if you're doing moonshots, 95% of the hard work is learning what the right answer is. It's only 5% that's the building. Now that you know that, our job is learning. It is not building. And you only learn in the moment where you have some theory about how the world is. Product theory, market theory, technical theory about physics of what you can build, how it'll work, whatever that is. And you're wrong. That is the moment where you learn, because if you're right, you didn't learn anything. If you only really learn in the moments where you had a model of the world and then you were surprised, you didn't get what you wanted, whatever else you want to call that, that moment feels like a failure. And if you feel bad in that moment, you will unconsciously, God forbid even consciously, avoid that moment. So if we want to be the world's best at creating moonshots efficiently, and we know that it's driven by tight learning cycles, and learning cycles only happen in the moment of failure, my God, is it important for us to make sure, at least in here at X, that everyone has successfully destigmatized failure. Because if you feel bad about it, you won't do it. And so we want to win in the end. We want our things to be nearly perfect in the end, or as perfect as we can make them. But in service of that, we want to find out all of the bad stuff about what we're trying to do as fast as possible. Finding it out later is not going to be any better.
That totally makes sense too. It's, I mean, I guess it's not that different than what a lot of other companies do, I think, like in terms of R&D and testing, but you guys are just accelerating the kind of failure state versus, I guess, overall testing. So how has that actually taught you something, you know, for Moonshot projects going forward? Can you list some like notable examples of things that really, that failure really taught you a lot about is something viable or not early on?
Sure. Well, I mean, since we were talking about Waymo, one of the examples that comes to mind is in the early days, we thought we were making a self-driving car. That's what we called it. And so we went out there and we had made cars that could drive themselves. This was 10 years ago now. And we gave them to Googlers who didn't work at X. And we said, you can use this on your commute back and forth to work, but you have to swear that you're going to be really good. You're going to keep your hands right by the steering wheel. And we're going to put cameras in the car to make sure you're really good. Oh, yeah, we promise, we promise. And these are good people who worked at Google. They meant it. And they did not keep their hands by the steering wheel. They were in the back seat. They were sleeping. They were eating. They're doing their makeup. Hands nowhere close to the steering wheel. It was so frightening that we stopped the experiment early. And we said, oh, God, humans are not a reliable backup for self-driving cars. The cars have to be able to drive themselves if the human is asleep, because we've watched people who promised us they were going to be good fall asleep on their way to work, which is why we stopped the effort. Now, we could have just canceled that project when it was still at X at the time, but we didn't. We said, oh, our job is not to make a self-driving car. Our job is to transform mobility. And that's why we started focusing on level 4 and level 5 autonomy and like not having humans as a backup. And in fact, because of other learning moments that were like that, in later years, Waymo learned that their job isn't even transforming mobility. It's to build the driver, which is even more focused and specific. So those are examples where we think we know what we're doing. We think we know how to do it. And then lots of details show up that surprise us, disappoint us sometimes, but we can react to them and we retool what we're doing to make what we're doing even more fit for purpose for society.
Gotcha. It is funny that existing car manufacturers are doing, you know, a semi-autonomous stuff, but with normal driving wheel, steering wheels and everything. I guess what you guys can do is leap beyond just retrofitting an existing product and making it work slightly better, but you can take that next step because jumping to level 4 and level 5 is incredibly tough. Are there any other projects you want to bring up that have been like that? Because you guys have talked about Loon quite a bit. In your TEDx talk, you brought up Loon a lot. And Loon was a cool idea, but that just never really came to pass. Yeah.
Well, let me give you two examples.
Sure.
Loon, these stratospheric balloons that were holding underneath them cell towers in the sky, basically, creating an ad hoc mesh network across the world, beaming LTE and 5G to people in rural areas. Unbelievably, after a lot of work, it worked. We were giving rural 4G and 5G service to people in several countries around the world, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of them. It was the business loop we just couldn't close for complicated reasons. We shut Loon down, but the lasers that were going back and forth between those balloons, the high bandwidth way that those balloons talk to each other and got a connection back to the internet backbone. Those lasers, now 7 years later, on the ground in 20 countries around the world, it's a box about this big, a little bit smaller than a stoplight. It shoots a laser, which is eye safe, you can't even see it, up to 20 kilometers. It has to be able to see another one of these boxes. But if these two boxes can see each other, you get a fiber optic cable in the sky without any cable. You don't have to trench the cable. It's like a thousandth the cost of trenching fiber. You can put it up in an hour. So right now in like 20 countries around the world, this, it's now an independent company. It's just graduated from X very recently, called Tara, is moving more data every 15 minutes to customers in 20 countries than Loon did in its 9-year history. That's an example of moonshot compost. We learned what we could. We took the bits that were most valuable for Loon, and it turned into something way better than Loon. Of course, I wish we could have jumped right to the right answer, but that's not really how innovation works.
Right, right. And Loon was a wild idea. Yeah, yeah.
Let me give you another example that we haven't actually shared publicly until literally yesterday. The way X works is, if I gave you a choice between choice A, choice B, you probably heard me do this. Choice A, you can give $1 million of value to your business this year guaranteed. Choice B, you can give $1 billion of value to this, to your business this year, but it's not guaranteed. It's one chance in 100. Choice B has 10 times the expected utility of choice A. So it makes sense that we would want everyone at X, at least, to be doing, constantly doing choice Bs. But choice B has a 99% chance of being a zero. That's the definition of that thought experiment. But in the thought experiment, we can all be like, yeah, but it's worth 10 times as much. We should do that all day long. Nobody does that. It's just too scary. We just announced one of the zeros that we got, but my God, are we proud of it. It turns out that there was some data that was gathered 40 years ago in the Naval Research Laboratory about fusion. It looked way better than people could explain. They tried to build a larger system to recreate the data, and they couldn't recreate it, but not in ways that really successfully explain why they had gotten that really exciting looking data before. It's basically making an icicle out of heavy water, deuterium and tritium, and then putting an icicle, putting a lightning bolt through the icicle at just the right ways, ramping up the voltage and the current, so that the icicle's desire to explode outward as this lightning bolt goes through it is just in balance. When you put a lightning bolt through something, there's a radial inward force, a squeezing like a giant's hands, that happens mechanically because of the field, the electrical field, the magnetic field that happens when current goes through something. If you could get those two things, the desire to explode outward and the desire to crush inward, to balance each other, you could have controlled fusion that would be hundreds, thousands of times cheaper and easier than the way other people are trying fusion right now. We just spent the last couple of years, we built a system, we did almost 1,000 shots on our system, we learned an incredible amount about it. If it had been the right way to do fusion, for a tiny fraction of what other people are doing, we would have been able to get something that would have been incredibly good for the world. We just decided very recently, it wasn't going to work. We've shut it down because that's what we do. We've explained it to the world in our podcast. If people are interested, it's on, you know, just look up Moonshot Podcast, Moonshot Factory, and you'll see it's episode 9. And I'm so proud of the team. They found a great thing to try. It was one of these choice Bs. They were incredibly scrappy and thoughtful in how they explored it. For a tiny amount of money, they built a working fusion system. Like, normally you have to spend $1 billion to do that. They didn't get, you know, 100 country miles of that. And then they were intellectually honest and said, experiment well run. It's still possible this would work. It's not looking promising enough to keep doing it. Let's close it down. Awesome. Exactly our job.
Gotcha. Is there anything else fusion related that you guys are looking at right now? Because this seems like a thing people are talking about. There have been developments in China that people haven't fully been able to like test against, but there are claims that China is building something that's kind of cool. Is there anything energy level or around energy that you guys are looking at?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we will come back to fusion at some point, but we don't believe our job is to find something everyone thinks is probably doable and then just muscle our way through it. We are trying to be explorers, to go try things that other people wouldn't try. If other people are going to try it, that's okay. You don't need us. Let's spend our energy on the stuff people won't try. And when we find another one of those things in the fusion space, we'll get back to it. But in the meantime, Tapestry, our moonshot for the electric grid, is doing exceptionally well. We're really proud of them. And they're showing up to grid operators around the world and having some increasingly profound impact on them. What they're doing with the whole country of Chile right now, I think, is substantively helping Chile bring in by years the time at which they're going to be fully off fossil fuels.
Could you explain a bit about what Tapestry does? I know we're running out of time.
Maybe most simply, everyone, this has been true for several decades, would like to make software that helps people manage the grid they have, plan for the grid they should have in the future, and then operate their grid in real time. But if you don't know what your grid is, you can't do that. Like the whole, that all that software services has to sit on the foundation of what is the schematic of your actual grid. Where's every wire, every transformer, every inverter? If you do not have that circuit diagram of your grid, you can't help them. And it turns out, if you go to any company in the world, including the grid operators, not because they're bad people, but because this stuff has been cobbled together over 120 years, they don't have the circuit diagram for their machine. It's the world's largest, most complex, and most expensive machine, the grid, and they just don't know where everything is. And so, much as we would have liked to do the fun part first, we spent 5-6 years and we got really good at using a lot of different sensor information and induction and deduction tools from machine learning and artificial intelligence to back out what their actual grid is, where every wire is, where every inverter is, where every transformer is, in enough detail that we then are now able to start offering to them how they can manage the grid they have, how they can plan for the grid of the future, and how they can start to make the grid into what it really wants to be when it grows up, which is a marketplace for electrons.
Awesome. Awesome. I mean, I hope to hear, I don't know, some of that working towards our grid too. We've done some reporting on, like, you know, America's grid is not as up to date as we'd like it to be, not as bad as Chile's, I'm sure.
If your listeners are interested, we've now announced that PJM, which is sort of the grid for the Eastern Seaboard of the United States, is working with Tapestry in very much these ways.
Very cool. Awesome. Astro Teller, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find the Moonshot Podcast?
If you just look at the Moonshot Factory, Moonshot Podcast on any browser, it'll show you our thing. And I really encourage people. I think you're going to have a great time listening to it.